Welcome back to the 9-8 podcast, the home of progressive and underground music here in Australia. My name is David Ellis, and with me always every fortnight is the fantastic, majestic, brilliant Mr. Alex Hogg from the west coast of Australia. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I unfortunately had the lack of foresight last night to get dragged into going out with some of the guys from work. And when work's paying for it, things can turn into a big night. So totally self-inflicted. Oh dear. But you know, that's how I'm doing at the this morning. A little dusty, I think, is probably the correct term.
But today is a historic day. Today is a fantastic day. Today, we're going to go track by track on the new Dream Theater record.
Fuck yeah, we are.
And it is going to be
fun. Obvious caveats apply. There is going to be a lot of spoilers for this particular episode. So if you have not listened to the record yet, this episode will be out on the day the record is available to buy.
Absolutely.
And if you've pre-ordered it, you should be getting your digital download sometime very shortly.
Absolutely.
So from here on in, massive spoilers for the record. If you haven't listened to it yet and you don't want to be spoiled, for Christ's sake, stop listening.
Absolutely.
Stop listening.
I'm going to reiterate that and say there are massive spoilers ahead for the entire album. Please do not listen to this if you want to listen to it first and then have a listen to what we have to say. Otherwise, go nuts. You have been warned.
Where do you want to start here with this record? Should we just go track by track, or do you want to give like the headline top bit? Do we recommend this album to people? Yes, no.
I think we should probably go track by track.
All right.
The first three tracks have already been released. We know that.
Yes.
Untethered Angel, yep. Paralyzed, and Fall Into the Light were all released as singles. I presume most people have actually heard these, but just a real cap off, I suppose, of those three tracks. I mean, Untethered Angel was the first one to be released, and then Fall Into the Light, and then Paralyzed. We've spoken about these on the show already. Fall Into the Light, not my favorite. Paralyzed is a ball terror, and Untethered Angel is also a ball terror. In actual fact, you're going to hear me say that a lot throughout this episode, because the entire album is a ball terror.
I was going to say, and the other thing you're going to hear me say a lot, I've said this many, many, many times already in the lead up to this record, that this album has a definite direct feel to it. In fact, if you all read my album review that I wrote for the Dream Theater Fan Club that we linked to on our Facebook page, you'll hear me compare this album to Rush's Permanent Waves. Hemispheres was kind of long and big and epic, kind of like The Astonishing. But and then Permanent Way, Rush at the end of that record said, okay, we're not doing one of those records again. That was way too much. They had a lot of problems recording that record. And so Permanent Waves, there was a definite consensus amongst the three of them to go in a direct kind of way.
Uh-huh.
And uh-huh. I liken this record, Distance Over Time, to that Permanent Waves record, is that they were all, it's like, okay, we're going to go in this direct, in this sort of focused direction.
Yeah,
so that's
absolutely.
Kind of the, and I think Untethered Angel is kind of, I would almost describe it as like a classic Dream Theater song, starting with that sort of, you know, that kind of spacey intro that we've seen used a number of times on Dream Theater songs.
Yep.
And then bang, straight into the main big progressive riff, driven by the guitar, driven with the big crunchy bass. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people were quite critical of The Astonishing is that the bass kind of wasn't there.
Yeah, absolutely.
On that record, it's back. It is back, and it is right at the front. There is no missing that big Jong Myung tone.
Absolutely. I think that was something that a lot of people were missing as well, just on a side note very quickly. People were missing for quite some time is that it was very hard to hear Myung for many, many years. And then I remember when Dramatic Turn of Events came out, people were like, holy shit, I can hear Myung again. So I think that was something that was, it might have been something that Portnoy had control of, but it certainly could have also been just the time of mixing and, you know, more modern studio techniques and more modern studio sounds as well that came along.
Possibly. I know Mike Portnoy spoke that the way that he sort of composed drum parts is that he was very untypical of a drummer in that he would tend to lock in with what First with what John Petrucci was doing, and then sometimes with what Jordan was doing with his left hand. He would kind of lock into that, as opposed to the traditional way of bass player and drummer sort of having that sort of interlocking, play. And so I think now that Mike Mangini's in the band, I think there's that more traditional sort of sense of that Mike Mangini and John Myung are very much interlocking, and there's so the drums are following the bass as opposed to the drums following the guitar, and then John Myung kind of has to sit in with what's happening between guitar and drums.
Yeah, yeah. No, I understand that. And it's, I mean, I'm not going to turn this into a Portnoy versus Mangini argument, you know, but they're both brilliant drummers, but they both have their own kind of style.
Absolutely.
I think Myung's starting to come into his own with this particular album, which is quite evident as you listen to it. Also, just really briefly, the drum sound on this album is actually decent. The last couple of albums, it sort of sounded like he's been hitting basketballs, but this album sounds a little bit more focused. There's a bit more of a crack to it, which is actually really nice, which I appreciate personally.
I wonder who did the mixing on this album? Is that Rich Chickie again? Did he do this one?
No, it was Ben Gross. Ben Gross that did the mixing, and Tom Baker was mastering.
Right.
Rich Chickie was the vocal. He's the engineer for vocal track, and he was also production as well as John Petrucci.
Nice. Ah, okay, I see. Yeah, I was just trying to think who did the mixing on the last couple of records, because I know Rich Chickie did a lot of mixing on the last couple of Rush records, and I know people complained about the sound on those records. So I wonder if that's not a similar sort of thing.
Oh,
just the way that Rich tends to mix things.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a topic that I know a lot of people get very, very sniffy about, and I generally don't have any strong opinions on because I'm not that much of an audiophile. You are, though, Dave, so fire away.
Look, I mean, the reality is that every single engineer, every single mixer and master and so on and so forth are all they've all got their own thing, right? So you've got, for example, you've got Nolly, who's quite famous for all the periphery stuff. When you listen to a Nolly mix and all the subsequent mixes really that have been inspired by Nolly, you have that snare drum right at the front. You have, you know, that real cracky kind of sound to the drums and things like that, and that dirty but clear and present bass. You've got people like Forrester Savill. Forrester Savill is really famous for fucking massive mixes, and what I mean by massive mixes is, you know, they sound like they're exploding out of the speaker, but nothing's missing, and they're not too trebly or anything like that. Everything's just nice, big and round. Then you also have, you know, people like Stephen Wilson, you know, phenomenal mixes that come out of that guy. But they're
everyone really, yeah, people seem to really, and all the audiophiles that I own, they seem to really hold highly his mixes. Whether or not that's just because it's Stephen Wilson, and there's definitely an element of the Stephen Wilson fan base that seem to think that everything he touches is gold.
I think that's a prog thing.
Yeah.
But
how interesting,
you know,
would it be? Yeah.
I think
it'd be interesting to get Stephen Wilson to mix a Dream Theater record one day. I don't think it'll ever happen. I'm pretty sure he's on record as being a not particularly big Dream Theater fan.
Wow, okay, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, he's not one much for the widdly-widdly kind of stuff. That's not his thing.
Yeah, well, that makes sense, I suppose. You know, this is a thing with Dream Theater. It's kind of an acquired taste almost. There's a lot of people who love it, and there's a lot of people that hate it. There's not really anyone I know of that's mediocre on Dream Theater.
The things that tend to take a beating from people who are not Dream Theater fans, it's like, number one, James LaBrie's voice. People seem to be, it's very much, people either really love, and people like me really, really love his vocals.
Yeah.
I think he's in a really, and people who hate him and think that, you know, he's a terrible vocalist and blah, 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 all the rest of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm definitely in the second camp. I don't think he's a terrible vocalist, I should say. I don't think he's a terrible vocalist. He's not my favorite vocalist, though. You know,
I didn't say he was my favorite. I just think he's a very distinctive voice, and 100%. And it's definitely something that at this point in their career, anyway, I don't think they could possibly ever change.
No,
I noticed that there are a lot of people who are saying that there seems to be a more, what's the word here that I can make this sound like processed kind of quality to James LaBrie's voice. I don't know whether that's just because they're getting better, like because he's now doing mixing of vocals on his own, he's able to sort of experiment with more of that sort of stuff and get a voice, a sound that he's happier with potentially. I don't know. Because there does seem to be a lot more treatment of his vocals, some of them, rather than some of the earlier stuff where it was just sort of like big and bold and kind of raw in the mix, if you know what I mean. There's more treatment, more production, and more sort of effects placed on his voice, which he's been doing for years. I mean, I seem to remember him talking about like the vocal effects that they had on like Train of Thought. So this is not exactly new technology.
Absolutely. And I mean, you got to remember as well that pretty well in every single album, I mean, even my band, we've just sent off our new single to be mixed and mastered. I think there's 4 main vocal tracks, and that's from the singer. And then you've got all the backing tracks, you've got all the chorus tracks, you've got all the, you know, I mean, half of the entire mix is all vocals. So, you know, that's just how it is. Particularly in metal, and particularly with the advent of digital doors and so on and so forth, you can just get away with doing a lot more, and it doesn't cost you any extra. You know, unlike back in the day when you were recording to tape, and you only had so much tape left, you know?
Also, as well, you know, a lot of people tend to record at home now as well, so you're not paying horrendous fees for, like, a proper recording studio where, you know, time, you know, costs however many $100 an hour to rent the thing, so you better make sure you get it done because, you know, once this take is done, we have to leave.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Mm. And that's certainly something that, only speaking from what my band is currently doing, our entire next album will be produced, you've seen my studio at home. It's all being produced there.
You exactly.
Know, there are no live drums on it. There are no live guitars, as in they're played, but they're played on an electric kit. The guitars are played into a desk, into a program on the computer. The bass is the same. The only thing that's really going to be done live, so to say, is the vocals, because you just don't have to do that stuff anymore. You know,
yeah, exactly. Anyway, we have digressed. We were supposed to be going track by track.
We've spoken
about the 3 single. We've spoken, I mean, Untethered Angel being the classic Dream Theater opener that they've done so many times. You know, they've done that sort of thing before with the clean guitar and then the big riff and then the vocals come in and that's apparently that opening riff, as in one of those videos where it's like John and Jordan and John talking about it. That's a John Myung riff, that opening riff.
It's interesting that's actually a John Myung riff, because I seriously think that guy is underrepresented. Like, some of the best Dream Theater lyrics, some of the best Dream Theater riffs and so on and so forth and progressions are all Myung.
Oh, yeah. I'm just trying to remember which one it was in Scenes from a Memory. That's the big, big John Myung riff. I think it's in Strange Deja Vu.
Right. Which one's his in Strange Deja Vu?
Yeah, it's the one in the middle where the riff, you know, back on my feet again, open to the real world.
Oh, yes.
That one. That's one of his.
Yeah, the back on my feet again.
Yes. That riff, that's a John Myung riff. And the whole band were caught out by, like, how big that sounded live, something that we're going to hear later on this year when Scenes from a Memory is being played live again.
Buck, yeah.
In its entirety. Yeah. That riff there, that's a big John Myung riff that he came up with, and everyone was like, wow, you know, we never really realized how big this was going to, like, rock live.
Yeah, it's a huge riff.
Oh, yeah. Like, so he's definitely, and to jump in a bit later to the album, another one, S2N, Signal to Noise, that's a John Myung lyric. And the riff out of that has to be one of his, because it starts with it's a big bass sound.
Yeah.
It starts from there and it just races off from there.
It's pretty big.
Yeah, that is going to be a big, big, big riff live. I'm putting my marker in the sand for that one. That's going to be big.
Hopefully they play it live.
It's a lot, but this, I can't imagine why they wouldn't, frankly. But that's
the thing. I mean, we've said that before. You know.
True. Well, I was going to say, there are a lot. I mean, this is, I think, typify what you were saying about like ball-tearing riffs. There are a lot of them on this record. There are sort of big, big sounds, big riffs on, you know, And then you get to the, some of the lighter stuff. I mean, people give this is the other thing I was going to say, is like people give crap to James LaBrie for his vocals, and people give crap to John Petrucci because it's like, oh, he's got no feeling. It's just a bunch of notes. And that's rubbish. I mean, the outro solo to At Wit's End, that's a beautiful solo. That kind of mix between Steve Rothery and David Gilmour, obviously with his own unique tone. But he does... At times, he can capture that mode quite nicely.
Yep, absolutely.
He definitely tried to capture it on Breaking All Illusions.
Yeah.
Obviously, with the very obvious sort of La Via Strangiato rush influence to that, the way that solo was constructed. That he gets pretty close to it sometimes. It can be really, really, really nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, hey, people just want to concentrate on him being some sort of mad shredder who just blazes a bunch of notes and that's that.
Well, I remember seeing him back in 2008 when... Was it 2008 or 2009? One of the
depending
two.
Which tour, depending on which tour you're talking about, I can give you the answer to that question.
I can't remember which tour it was. But it was when... It must have been 2009 because it was the day of the gig. And I went with Simo to the Petrucci Clinic. We actually had to Rochambeau for it because it was John Petrucci or Mike Portnoy doing a drum clinic or Petrucci doing a guitar clinic. And I remember he basically walked onto stage and said, look, I don't really know what to say. It works way better if you guys just ask me questions. I think the first question that came out was something like, oh, can you play the arpeggio part from the sweep picking part from The Glass Prison? And the look on his face was like, oh, fuck, this again? Like, fuck, really?
Yeah.
You know?
And everybody wants to talk about the shredding and the big sweep. Very, very complicated guitar part, but if that's all people want to see and hear, I think, it's like, ugh. You know?
Because when he does those beautiful solos, like one of my favorite solos of his, hands down, is the ending solo from The Count of Tuscany.
Okay.
Gorgeous. Like you hear it and it just it's epic and heroic and you just want to listen to it again and again and again and again and again. You know, it's a great solo.
The one that I particularly enjoy in a similar sort of vein is Take Away My Pain.
Yes.
From Falling Into Infinity.
Yes.
And it always shits me. I've heard the original version, the pre-Kevin Shirley fucked version. Because he kind of took that and turned it into a roller coaster ride at Disneyland with the way that the original version on the original 96 demo is a beautiful solo. And I really, really hate how Kevin Shirley fucked with it.
But even on Falling Into Infinity, Lines in the Sand.
Yeah.
Like that is...
It's definitely... Yeah.
That is the... I remember re-listening to it probably 2 or 3 years ago. I hadn't listened to that song, the live version from Once in a Lifetime. And I re-listened to it and went, fuck, that is where my influence comes from. Like, everything in that solo is exactly how I play live.
Yep.
It is that just wooden, open, beautiful tone with this playing that is just exactly where it needs to be when it needs to be.
Yeah.
You know?
The other thing as well, I mean, if I was to go to a John Petrucci clinic, I'd be more interested in listening to him describe how he writes a solo rather than him just showing off.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. There seems to be sort of an element of like just showing off at these sorts of clinics, which is why I generally don't go. Because I'm like, I'm not a guitar player. I certainly don't pretend to be one on the internet. But that seems to be this element of like just watching people shred. I know people had a similar complaint when they went to see Yngwie Malmsteen's guitar clinic, which should be a surprise to nobody. I'm saying that's all he does.
I mean, the question is at the Yngwie Malmsteen clinics is whether or not there are any donuts there for everyone else or whether or not there's just donuts for Yngwie.
God damn it. God damn it, Dave.
But, I mean, that whole... The thing with Petrucci, and one of the key reasons I think we're talking about it is because in a recent interview, Petrucci actually said that he believes that guitars sort of drive the sound of a band. And I somewhat agree with him on that.
Oh, absolutely.
Of course, I'm biased because I'm a guitarist, but
Yeah, exactly. But it's always the it's been the prominent instrument in rock music for 50 or 60 years now. It's always been all the way back to, you know, Chuck Berry, or, you know, even further back than that probably.
Yeah, 100%.
Since that point, it's been the guitar that has been the driving force of a song.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know? And I think in a band as well, where you've got two sort of gods of, like, you know, quote unquote shred music. You've got John Petrucci and you've got Jordan Rudess. John Myung, the poor guy, is sort of away in sort of, you know, an amazing bass player and phenomenal sound and kind of tone. But next to those two, it's kind of like the shred kings. Sort of how I feel about Alex Lifeson in Rush. It was like you had Neil Peart, who is arguably one of the greatest rock drummers who's ever lived, and then you've got Geddy Lee, who's doing singing, bass, keyboards, and bass pedals all at once. And then you've got Alex Lifeson, who on his own is a phenomenal guitar player, but next to those two, he's kind of like underrated in a way.
Yeah, yeah. I understand exactly what you're talking about. And I think this album actually does a really good job of balancing all of that together.
Oh, yeah. That's just what I'm saying about the more direct feel. There's less sort of, you know, just mad long solos and big unison sections. Everything is sort of, but you're not missing any, there's no missing out anything. You've still got the lighter stuff with, you know, At Wit's End. And then you've got the big heavy riffs of, you know, Untethered Angel and Paralyzed. And you've still got the really, really heavy progressive stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, we spoke as well, we alluded to this earlier, so now I'm going to jump into it. Viper King starts off with it's kind of a 9/16 riff.
Yep.
Now, that 9/16 riff has been kicking around since the Dream Theater drummer auditions from 8 years ago.
Yep, yep.
When I first heard it, I was like, I've heard this riff before. Where have I heard this riff before?
Yep, you actually picked it. And yeah. I've got to admit, I didn't pick it.
It's not quite the same, but it's pretty bloody close.
Yeah, exactly. Because when I went back and re-listened to it, I'm like, it's not identical. But if that's not the same riff that's been worked, mate, I mean, seriously, I'll shut this whole thing down. Seriously, but fuck, yeah.
We'll have to find out about that one. But that song, I mean, this is the bonus track, and this was why in those earlier episodes when we first talked about it, me having heard this record, I said to people, it's like, buy the special edition. You need to hear this bonus track, because Viper King is like an ultra-progressive Deep Purple's Highway Star.
Absolutely, and I'm going to say,
he's singing about fast cars and driving down the road and the big, you know, it just sounds like a cross between Deep Purple's Highway Star and Rush's Red Barchetta.
Exactly,
in that sort of style. And then it's a big, big guitar solo and a big, I think it's like a, is Jordan playing the continuum on that one? It sure sounds like it.
It's possible.
Possible. There's definitely a big Hammond organ sound in there as well.
Which I've got to say, I love the fact that there's a Hammond organ in this album. It's so cool. It's great to actually hear a proper instrument. You know,
it's like, not all Hammond organ, though, because obviously there's other stuff underneath it. This is one of the great strengths of Jordan's keyboard playing is the stacking and the layering of sounds. A lot of other keyboard players, a lot of other bands is sort of like just the one sound, which is kind of like straight out of the box from a Moog or a Korg or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, but he will layer the synths. You haven't already seen it, he put out an instructional video many years ago around about the Train of Thought album, Keyboard Madness, where he was talking about how he layered synths. It's really, really interesting to listen to him and how he's come up with these different sounds. It's like there's one sound on one of the Scenes of Memories album where it's like 20-something odd different synth sounds layered on top of each other. He's got like a trumpet, and then he's got like a different kind of trumpet, and then there's like a sine wave sound, and it stacks all these, you know, 20-something odd patches together to create this one sound. And it's amazing how he does it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you listen to, you know, other keyboard sounds, and it's like, oh, I see elements of that in what they're doing, but not to the same level. And that's obviously like Jordan's strength is all that technology and layering of the sounds and stuff. And I think that's what brings a really, really progressive quality to Dream Theater's music is that layering of the synth sounds.
Absolutely. I think it's his knowledge of music and how it all sits.
Yes, absolutely.
Because you inevitably, when you start adding more layers to things and more layers to things and more layers to things, you start to use up the sonic space in a track, right? Somehow, he manages not to use the sonic space up in a track. And I've fucked if I know how he does it, but the man's a god.
Like through careful set. Through careful orchestration.
That's true. Yeah.
You know.
So really quickly, the three singles off this album, as we mentioned, Untethered Angel, Paralyzed, and Fall Into the Light. Which weren't released in that order. They were actually released in Fall Into the Light was first and then Paralyzed. What's the standout? Which one is the standout for you?
Ooh, that is a tough one. I think Untethered Angel, because that was first, that's kind of like the touchstone for what I was thinking this record was going to be. But Paralyzed is such a great song. It's such a great song. Mm-hmm. So concise. And there's a really, really great guitar solo in the middle of that.
Isn't there? And the...
Hi.
I said, isn't there? Like, fucking hell.
Yeah. But it's so concise. I mean, the track itself is only four, the song's only 4 minutes long. And I know this isn't, you know, we've talked about this before. It's like, you know, there's no long songs on this and, you know, all that sort of thing. I really don't subscribe to that. I think it's, I don't know. It's kind of a toss up between Untethered Angel and Paralyzed for me. Mm. And it's like, you know, the top two is definitely of all the tracks on the album. It's a toss-up for me between S2N and Viper King for which one is my favorite on the record far.
Okay.
This always changes as well. Something will stand out and go, yeah, this is my favorite track on the album. I remember on a Dramatic Turn of Events, I remember really, really enjoying... which one was it? I think it was Outcry. Really enjoyed that one. And then it shifted, and then... The favorite one for me on that record is probably Beneath the Surface. I really, really love that. It's a beautiful song.
It's a gorgeous song, that one. You know, I mean, I think this is, once again, this is, you know, back to their ability as musicians and their writing ability. Some of the best stuff that they do isn't the heavy, crazy, you know, biddly, 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 biddly stuff. It's all the beautiful, I mean, arguably they're probably the most popular song, whether or not it's their best song or their most fan-loved song,
Spirit Carries On.
Thank you. That was the one I was thinking of.
That would have been my pick. It's like that is definitely the fan favorite.
Absolutely. The Spirit Carries On. Phenomenal song. Lyrically, unbelievable. You know, very, very direct again. And I think this is the thing that a lot of fans look over. They do direct very, very well. They don't get a lot of kudos for it. They don't get a lot of, oh, yeah, man, like, you know, Dream Theater, have you heard that new 25-minute song they did? Or what about Change of Seasons and all that sort of stuff? Or Octavarium?
I think we've already discussed on this show, you've mentioned Change of Seasons, and I have to jump in here. I think we've already discussed on this show my somewhat negative attitude towards a Change of Seasons. I don't particularly like that one at all.
I have never heard this. You need to explain yourself, sir.
Really? Okay. I've tried many, 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 many times to get into a Change of Seasons. It's like, you know, it's a 23-minute Dream Theater song. How could I not? I just, some of the sounds on the, I don't know. I think because I came to that song quite late.
Yeah.
Because I sort of went back to it as opposed to like coming up to it. The problem is, I think, is I got to, and it's like, there's a definite sort of Derek Sheridan kind of quality on that album with some of the sounds, and I'm like, yeah, it doesn't really work.
Do yourself a favor and listen to the version from Live Scenes from New York.
Oh yeah, yeah,
way better.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, especially when they drop in the Simpsons theme song into the middle of one of the guitar solos. That's hilarious. I think the Major League Baseball theme is in there somewhere as well. From memory,
it is. They all of them get a solo. Petrucci does the Simpsons one. Myung does the Major League Baseball. That thing. And Jordan just does his normal ragtime thing. But it is a phenomenal track.
Yeah. I've tried quite a number of times, and I know John Petrucci is no fan of that guitar solo in the middle of the song.
Really?
Yeah, it's in the Lifting Shadows book.
right.
He had this guitar solo, which was just sort of done very quickly as like a quick take sort of thing, as like a placeholder. And Kevin Shirley really, really loved it. And John said, "No, it's rubbish. I can do a better one than that." And he came back in with some other guitar solo, which Kevin Shirley said was like, you know, I think the words were, "Who are you trying to impress with that, Steve Vai?" Because apparently it was just like a big flurry of the big stuff. And Kevin's like, "Trust me, John, this other solo you've done, yeah, it's quick and it's kind of rough in places or whatever, but it's better. Trust me on this one." And Kevin talked him into it. And John Petrucci says, "Yeah, even now I'm not crazy about that solo."
Yeah, really, because I actually really like that solo.
Yeah, it's definitely, like you're saying, we're talking about that sort of Rothery, Gilmore kind of quality to it.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons I really like it is because it's rough.
Yeah.
You know,
and not everything has to be. Well, this is the thing, I think this is why I've always wanted to find out. I sort of read around it that John Petrucci tends to be more of a composer of solos rather than just sort of like the Alex Lifeson thing where they just push the button on the recorder and let him go.
Yeah. Yeah, see, I'm more the latter than the former, I will admit. Okay,
yeah.
You know, just press play, all right, let's see what I come up with. I'll do 15 takes, piece all the good bits together and then re-record it, you know, learn it and re-record it kind of thing. Whereas, yeah, John is more, I think, sit at the computer, okay, I'm going to compose this and da-da-da, which is probably the right way to do it in inverted quotes.
Well, it's not necessarily a right way about it. It's just like that's sort of his style. I know he does talk about sometimes where he has improvised. I know the solo in Voices, he said that was like I just sort of went for it,
yep,
kind of thing. And that one, I think that one was really, really good as well. So I know I keep bringing up Rush on this time, and I think Dream Theater, you know, 30 years into their career now, probably should have shaken the Rush influences off themselves. But I keep bringing back to it as like, you know, Neil Peart was definitely more of a compositional drummer.
Yeah.
And then he sort of, a good portion of the way into his career, and went, "Screw this, I want to be an improvisational drummer," and then kind of went that in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
It takes a lot of guts to do that 30 something odd years into your career as
well, absolutely.
I might add.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's why the man's a god. Sidebar as well on that, actually, there was a you know, when Geddy Lee's going around with his Big Bass Tour book, where he keeps talking about, people keep asking him, "Oh, is Rush going to get back together? Rush going to get back together?" Apparently Neil Peart hasn't played the drums in 3.5 years.
Jesus, really?
Yeah, he's literally given, he's like, "Nope, done."
Wow, okay.
Hasn't played the drums in 3.5 years, apparently.
That's a shame. I think that's a real shame.
I'm not
shame.
Surprised. I'm not that surprised at all, actually.
I'm not surprised about it, but I still think it's a shame.
Yeah.
All right, so we've digressed a bit, which is totally not a thing that we always do in this podcast. But the first three tracks, all right, we've got Untethered Angel, Paralyzed, and Fall Into the Light. They are the three singles off the brand new Dream Theater album, Velocity, as we're calling it, Distance Over Time. Track number four, Barstool Warrior. What did you think, my friend?
This particular one is very different lyrically than all the others. Generally speaking, when I'm listening to these sorts of albums, I tend to concentrate on the music first and then come back to the lyrics sort of secondarily.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a John Petrucci lyric, but it's very, very interesting in that it's a very different lyrics to what John Petrucci has usually done. Usually he's either writing about there's a lot of spiritual energy, terrible phrase, but I'm going to use it anyway, in the way that he constructs, the way he writes lyrics. There's a lot of spirituality in it. You could almost imagine it being like it's very real. Yeah, he's done real stuff as well with A Nightmare to Remember and Wither, where he talks about, you know, writer's block and, you know, a horrible car accident he had when he was a kid. This is very, very real. It's sort of a man sitting at the end of a bar, thinking about his life and how it's, you know, come to be and all that, and then the big change, you know, the big change at the end.
Yep.
It's a very different lyric, which is very, it's rather a good one, actually. I was a little bit surprised to learn that it was a John Petrucci lyric. I thought this was one of John Myung's. It sound very sort of JM in that way.
Yep, exactly my thought. I've got to admit, this is my favourite track on the entire album, Barstool Warrior. I absolutely adore this track. Because it is,
I thought you might.
Lyrically, it is unbelievable, right? You sit there, you listen to it, and you can paint the picture in your head. And that is something I think that a lot of lyricists need to be able to do. And so few can.
I was going to say the other one that sort of it reminds me of, and it reminds me of it because it's actually sitting here in my recording room, is the have you seen the cover for Marillion's Clutching at Straws?
Yes.
This song reminds me of that cover.
Yep, I know exactly where you're going with this.
Similar sort of vibe as well. I mean, a lot of stuff like Torch Song and Sugar Mice from that record, that's the similar sort of story is trying to be built of, like, you know, man coming to terms with, you know, how his life has gone so far and sort of failed ambitions and all that sort of thing. So there's definitely that vibe. John Petrucci's talked, he's at least spoken to me about it, at least about his influence, the influence of Fish on his lyrics.
Mm,
yeah. Maybe not necessarily in the way that Fish writes his lyrics. That was definitely more the Kevin Moore end of the situation. Kevin Moore was very influenced by Fish. But just in the imagery and the way that Fish is able to conjure up, and still does it very, very well, conjure up the imagery in his lyrics.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, man. Bastard Warrior is, as I said, for me, it's my favorite track on the album. It's so good. It is, for me, it's early on when we were talking about this album, I said this album is basically Awake meets, from what I'd heard at the time, it was like Awake meets Falling Into Infinity. Bastard Warrior is definitely from the Falling Into Infinity spectrum. It's from that end.
Oh, absolutely.
Of the
Stuff like Hollow Years, Take Away My Pain, that sort of imagery, that way of sort of looking at it.
Even also New Millennium. Well,
New Millennium's a Mike Portnoy lyric, though. That's
I know, but I'm just talking tonally, like the actual song itself. It's very
It's
akin
also got
to
like
that.
Another Day kind of quality as well.
Yep, exactly.
That similar sort of vein. Yeah, maybe it isn't that far away from a John Petrucci lyric then, if we've just come up with three more that sort of remind us of that sort of vibe.
But they're few and far between.
They are.
You know what
they
I mean?
Are. He does.
This is not a sort of attack on Petrucci's ability, whether it be as a lyricist or anything else, a producer or anything. Sometimes you just have songs that just work, and this is one of them. Like I said, for me, favorite track on the album, hands down.
Yeah. I think that was a quality that was. I know that in the album reviews that were written by other people, there was some criticism of the quote unquote Roadrunner era albums, which I think this is the first one with Inside Out Music.
Yeah.
And then we get to Room 137.
Oh, okay. Now we're talking.
Yes, which is and has been confirmed by numerous sources because I was a little bit dubious of it. This is the Mike Mangini lyric.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what did you think of this one?
Yeah, so, I mean, the lyric is far more direct. I mean, you have you look at Bastard Warrior. Bastard Warrior is kind of like this giant, gorgeous oil painting of, a scene in front of you. And the more you look at it, the more that you sort of pick up all the nuances and you see, all the rest of the story and everything like that. Room 137 is kind of more like a sledgehammer to the face. You don't really need to look at it very long to understand what's going on. it, however, is, again, a brilliant song. And that riff is just, oh, man. It's the only criticism I have about it is the fact that it just starts. I would have liked to have seen something sort of an intro sort of to the song rather than it just dropping in, but that's just,
it is a bit of an oddball, that one, definitely in that way. It's interesting, actually. I was reading through some of the fan reviews and Victoria Martinez of the US fan club describes the chorus as Beatlesque.
Really?
What? Yeah.
Beatlesque
chorus section. Yeah.
What Beatles is she listening to?
Probably the more John Lennon stuff, I would have thought.
I must ask her about that, actually, because I certainly don't see it as Beatlesque. But
so there you are, Victoria. If you are listening, please get in touch with us. We'd love to have a bit more of a follow up of what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to know, what you mean by Beatlesque. It's a great. What about you? What do you think of the song?
I really enjoyed it. It's a different flavor. I mean, Mike's lyrics is the song about someone who's obsessed with patterns and numbers and hidden messages and stuff. Yeah. So it's a different take on the usual sort of Dream Theater lyrics that we're used to, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not a bad thing at all. I welcome Mangini into writing lyrics and so on and so forth. I think it's absolutely great.
Yeah,
that he's doing.
It's the one question I didn't actually get to ask Jordan last time I spoke to him was, why don't you write lyrics?
But yeah, I don't know. Room 137. Yeah, obsessed with numbers and patterns, and it seems to be quite apt, I suppose, coming from Mangini, who is one of those drummers who. I remember when I interviewed him when he joined the band for A Dramatic Turn of Events, and he was saying, yeah, you know, I could play everything that Petrucci wrote exactly to the T, but I found I had to put some slight swing on it and delay some notes and things like that to make it sound less mechanical. I go, hang on a second. So you're actually intentionally not putting notes where they're supposed to go because you want it to sound more human. Yeah, exactly. The fuck? Are you serious? Like the guy is a monster. He is a monster of a player, and especially if this track is all about, you know, obsession over numbers and patterns and things like that. Totally apt, I reckon. Which brings us to the next track, Signal to Noise.
Oh yeah.
Another Myung.
This one, I think, is talking about. This is obviously a Myung lyric, even if it wasn't. I mean, there was a picture posted actually on one of the. I think it was on their Facebook page,
yeah.
Which showed like the big book, and it showed the lyrics for Singles to Noise. This one is a co-written of John, of the two Johns.
Yeah, that's right.
Which has happened, you know, numerous times through the course of the band's career, which that's led right, to that yep. sort of. I think it's been overplayed, but that sort of didactic sort of dictum from. Probably came from Mike Portnoy that the lyrics have to be presented to the band in its full form.
Yeah, yeah.
Because a lot of the other stuff, like, needed, you know, John Myung would sort of write something that was kind of loose and free form, and it would be up to one of the other members of the band to kind of impose some sort of form and structure to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Since Mike Portnoy has now departed the band, it's obvious that John Myung is sort of a little bit more, you know, sort of write and still writing those lyrics. Just, but now, it's obviously a little bit open to the idea of, like, being sort of a. You know, a little bit more form, you know, that sort of form and structure being imposed upon it.
Yeah.
From what you were going
to
say?
On that, just with Mike leaving the band, there's something I always wanted to ask them. And I don't mean to be rude. So if the guys are listening to this and you get offended about it, I do apologize. I'm guessing when Portnoy was in the band, they couldn't have alcohol anywhere near recording spaces or anything like that.
Yeah, recording spaces, backstage, et cetera, et cetera.
100%. Yes. Yeah, and rightly so, because, you know, the whole AA thing and
him recovering alcoholics is just generally a good idea just to keep it. Well, it was mentioned in the book as well that, like, on the 6 Degrees of Inner Turbulence tour, they would check into a hotel. John Petrucci would come into Mike's room, open up the minibar, empty the minibar into a bag and walk out with it.
Yeah.
It was like, we're just not having that anywhere in here.
Yeah.
And that would happen every single time they checked into a hotel. So, you know, that goes to the level of it.
Yeah, exactly. But interestingly, I was looking at that behind-the-scenes recording of this album, and there was an interview with John going on, and they were standing in the little sort of galley kitchen thing. And I swear to you, he was pouring himself a bourbon and Coke.
Yeah, there was mentioned that, like, sort of, I think with that barbecuing and the sort of the bourbon influence was definitely mentioned.
Yeah, so I wonder how that has changed things socially within the band.
Well, it's definitely a thing when you can. I know Morellian have talked about this. It's like they tend to go away. They do some of their recording at Peter Gabriel's studio in Real World Studios. It's owned by Peter Gabriel, and they do that. They go away and they sort of do what Dream Theater have just done. Go away into a place and spend 24 hours together, live, eat, sleep, breathe music. And the element to that is that Morellian do talk about that influence of being able to have a nice dinner, open a couple of bottles of wine, and then go into the studio and jam, which they can't do in their own recording studio in Aylesbury because they all have to drive home.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a definite element of that, of being able to have that camaraderie, of being able to enjoy a glass of wine or bourbon or whatever they happen to be drinking socially, and then go into a studio and record and then try and write with that influence.
Yeah, yeah. So sorry, it was just something I noticed, and I was always wondering about that, and I'd really like to hear from the guys. I mean, I don't know if they listen to this at all, but
I can pretty well guarantee they don't.
I can dream, Harold. if by chance they happen to be listening to that, I'd really like to know how that's changed things socially within the band.
I'll leave you to phrase the question for that one, Dave. It's like it could sound like a really horrible question.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I've done a good enough job of explaining the fact that I'm not trying to make it a horrible question. It was just something I was very, very interested in.
I dare say the answer would be similar to the sort of the idea of being able to have a few drinks and then that social aspect of then going into the studio and writing.
Yeah.
Something you can't do when you're in you're either your own studio or, in a suburban studio, because then you all have to drive home. The point I was going to get to before we diverted onto discussions about bourbon is that this lyric is very much how I imagine John sort of has his life, where I think is talking about the way I sort of think, like signal to noise. I sort of think about the lyric as like reducing the levels of outside noise in your life. And this is a very popular topic amongst people in the public eye, of like not listening to all the bullshit that you can get from sort of like Never Enough.
I was about to say,
in that same sort of way, it's like listening to all the outside stuff of fans sort of imposing what they think the band should be doing, or I don't like this, I don't like that, you should do more of this, less of this, whatever. It's like you just sort of block all that out, and then you find from within yourself or from some other kind of spiritual place what the guiding force in your life should be.
Exactly it. I don't know if that's exactly what the lyric is about, but I'm happy to roll with that. I'm in agreement with you on that.
We've discussed this before about, I don't think I told you the story that Rick Wakeman mentioned when got to do a little where the guy comes up to and talks about to John Anderson about Sound Chaser, and it's about this and that and the Shastric scriptures and blah blah blah, and then John Anderson says, "Yep, fantastic, you've nailed it. That's exactly what I was going for." And then he says to Rick Wakeman, and Rick says, "Oh, is that what it was about?" And John's like, "Nah, it was about taking a boat ride."
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah. But if someone's happy to read that, I think this is one of the really powerful things about music. You can have as much interpretation in it as you like, and people will read their own messages into pretty well everything.
Well, actually, another fun diversion as well. There was a bit of a blow up on one of the Marillion forums. Actually, there's a song on, you probably know the song as well, actually, on this Strange Engine called "An Accidental Man."
Yep, great and song.
It is a great song. And it's a beautiful lyric by Steve Hogarth, and he's sort of talking about how he doesn't feel like a sort of manly man because he grew up in like the north of Yorkshire and like in the coal mining districts and all that sort of stuff. So he never sort of felt that way about being like a man. Someone on the forums wrote in, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, but I believe this person is transgender and was wondering if that had influenced the way that Steve had written about the song. It turns out that the answer to that question is no, but it was a really interesting way of seeing the lyric, and boy, was there a massive argument about that.
Why?
Oh, I have no idea. I came to the argument very late, and by the time I got there, Lucy, the band's manager, who's the admin of that forum, turned the comments off and essentially deleted some of the post. I think she deleted the post.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So I came to it very late and saw the aftermath. And with a lot of people asking, "Oh, what's this about? What's this about?" And Lucy's like, "Yeah, no, I'm not opening this can again. We've it's been discussed. We're just gonna, because he didn't want it to like drag on and on and on."
Yeah, no, understandable.
The fan base in that particular world have a real sort of there's a lot of discussion around the lyrics. Then I remember when they wrote Gaza and they put the lyrics to Gaza out, and I think there was something like 1,500 comments on one particular thread about the back and forth about what Gaza was about.
Yeah.
Which I should point out, for those of you who maybe may have been listening, is a humanitarian, not a political statement.
Yeah.
Yeah, people hear the word Gaza and they immediately blow up and think it's about this, that, or the other, and it really isn't.
Yeah, yeah.
So then we move along in this record to two sort of ballady type songs, both of which are James LaBrie lyrics.
Yes.
This for him is definitely not sort of new territory. He's, you know, stuff like Far From Heaven.
Yeah.
And those sorts of lyrics, similar sort of, you know, also as well, he wrote Anna Lee, didn't he?
Yeah, it is.
So in that, yeah, similar in that, you know, sort of in talking about relationships, and this is about the aftermath. It's just sort of, it's been interpreted as the aftermath of abuse and a victim not wanting her past trauma to interfere with her current relationship, which is a really, really difficult, sad subject. Very, very complex.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the song itself is beautiful. I mean, I've already spoken as well about, you know, the outro solo to that. It's a beautiful, beautiful solo with James sort of in the sort of background in the mix saying, "Don't leave me now," over and over and over again. It's a really, really beautiful, beautiful sort of vibe they're able to capture there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, hats off to LaBrie for tackling a very sensitive issue, particularly in today's climate, particularly in today's world. I mean, yeah, shit. I know that one of the reviews on that Dream Theater Club link that we've popped down in the show notes was saying that you know, the whole idea of trusting love to get you through really difficult things, wanting to save that abusive relationship despite the fact that it is so abusive, if indeed that's what the song's about. You know, it's a very complex song, not just emotionally but also musically as well. It's a standout. It's an absolute standout on the album.
Yeah, it is. It's a really, really beautiful, beautiful song.
Yeah. It's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous.
That tension and release, which I think is something the Dream Theater do particularly well, that sort of building of tension and release. Yeah. And this song, I think, is definitely a fantastic exemplar of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they do build up and release better than most bands, in my opinion. And the other thing they do very well as well is build up to endings.
So At Wit's End has definitely got that big build up. It's kind of got that. I mean, another one of Dream Theater's obvious influences is Yes. And I'm thinking about this one in the same way of, I'm sure you're familiar with Yes's big song, Starship Trooper.
Yeah, of course. I'm also familiar of the Dream Theater cover of it.
Ah, cool. So, you know, it all builds up to that big, big solo at the end and those sort of chords and it sort of plays out from there.
Yeah.
If anyone out there isn't familiar with that song, for Christ's sake, remedy that now. Go and listen to it.
Absolutely. I'm fairly certain Dream Theater did a cover of that.
They probably have.
I'm pretty sure it was on the Black Clouds and Silver Linings bonus disc.
They have covered it because it's at the Ronnie. Well, they covered a certain portion of it anyway with Steve Howe, the Ronnie Scott's gig, now that I remember.
Right, there you go.
Yeah, they did they did a big Yes medley, and Starship Trooper is the one that ended up on the DVD. But they did a whole bunch of them. They did Machine Messiah, they did a bit of Close to the Edge, they did a whole bunch of stuff. But Starship Trooper is the one that ended up on the DVD.
Yeah. That's the one I'm thinking of. It was from the covers, which is an unofficial release. Whenever I think of Dream Theater's ability of build up and release kind of thing, I think of the end of Only a Matter of Time, from When Dream and Day Unite, right? Because if you watch the version of that from the Live at Budokan DVD, that ending is so fucking good. You know, everything's like that. It's really low build up, sort of, and then it just builds up to this screaming, you know, ending, this crescendo right at the end, and then just cuts straight off. And you go, fuck. Like, it's exactly how it's supposed to do it. And they do it so well. You're exactly right. Dream Theater, I think, do it better than. I'm going to go out on a limb and say probably any other band, but there are some other examples out there, obviously, but they do it very, very well.
Yeah, they do. And the other band I was going to mention as well. Hey, Dave, see if you can guess which band I'm going to mention.
I'm going to Yes, Marillion.
Yeah! Spot the Super Marillion fan. Hey! They do it particularly well. I mean, I mentioned already as well, Gaza. That's a big guitar solo in there, which I've always wondered how the hell Steve Rothery came up with it. And then it just sort of magically cuts out and then goes into this big sort of open synth section and a really, really haunting lyric after that. So I think they do it particularly well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
The Marillion influence on Dream Theater as well should not be understated. There are definite, I think there's a whole section in A Change of Seasons that they've openly acknowledged as Marillion sounding, and they are right. There is a...
Well, they've been...
They opened for Marillion back in the late 80s.
Yeah.
A couple of times.
Yeah. But, they've also been known... Like, Dream Theater have been known to name parts of their songs after... whomsoever the song was,
the whole Another World section from A Change of Seasons, I'm pretty sure they called that the Marillion section.
Yeah, which is a whole section in the Dance of Eternity called the Meshuggah section. And somewhat ironically, it broke the sound system in Sweden when they played it. Arguably, they do Meshuggah better than the Meshuggah do. So At Wit's End, great song, brings us to Out of Reach.
Out of Reach, I sort of feel is in a similar vein to At Wit's End. That's sort of another James LaBrie lyric, another song about sort of love and relationships and that sort of thing. So what did you think about this one, Dave?
I really liked it. Surprises none, the guitar work.
I thought you might say that.
Beautiful, beautiful singing solo, sort of at the first third into the actual song. Also, the vast majority of the song is just done on guitar and probably first half, I should say, is done on guitar and piano and vocals. And then it sort of all kicks in. This is sort of more a radio friendly one, and I'm kind of surprised they didn't release it as a single, to be really honest with you, because it's very much a single sort of song.
This is the problem with ballads, though, and I think we've talked about ballads before. It's like ballads work as singles if you're already an established act getting radio play. If there's singles coming from Dream Theater, I think there's a certain expectation it's going to be sort of heavy and progressive with a big solo. If they tried this as well. Like, I mean, Hollow Years was put out as a single and that went nowhere.
Yeah, which surprises me because it's a fantastic song.
It is a fantastic song, but they spent $100,000 putting a video together and all the rest of it, and it went nowhere. Nobody played it, and it just sort of died a death. And that was the song for them that was like started off this sort of hiatus of like, we're not doing music videos because it's a bloody waste of money. It cost $100,000. They sit on a shelf. MTV don't play it. Now it's a bit different because now with YouTube and stuff, music videos totally make sense because you can put something up there and get a couple hundred thousand views out of it.
It makes more
sense now because you're not reliant on terrestrial radio and MTV, even though MTV don't actually play any music anymore. They're more interested in like Jersey Shore and all that sort of crap. One day you'll get me wound up enough about reality TV to do that, to do a whole bit, but this is not today. So I don't think Out of Reach would work as a single because, I mean, maybe in this day and age it kind of would, because you could put it out, you could do like a really nice music video for it and have like a, you know, the big thing and all that.
I would actually really like to see Out of Reach over the original video for Another Day, because I reckon it'd work.
Ooh, interesting. I would have thought it would have worked over The Silent Man.
Yeah, either or, really.
Yeah, I was thought The Silent Man, that video clip, I think that, you know, that same sort of idea for that video with that song, if you know what I mean. That was the one that Mike Portnoy directed as well, actually.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. The only criticism, and this is a very, very small criticism that I have of Out of Reach, I don't quite understand why Patricia used the electric guitar underneath the piano.
I know what you mean. That sort of, yeah.
I was kind of hoping for an acoustic, you know? But that's, I mean, this is me being stupid critical. And realistically,
if it was going to be an acoustic, though, I think it would have to be a 12-string. Wouldn't a 12-string be a...
Yeah, that'd be nice, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. You sort of get that. You kind of get that 12-string kind of quality to it with a slight twist.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about it. I was like, I know John Petrucci is very influenced by Alex Lifeson's guitar tone and the way that he constructs passages with a lot of common tones and a lot of open strings and all that sort of thing, to the point where sometimes he'll be playing a passage and he'll be like, with his all his big electronic stuff, and he'll be like, uh-oh, no, this is too much. I need to kind of pull it back a little bit.
Yeah.
And I kind of, when I was listening to this song, I was kind of thinking about that. I was like, okay, I see where he's going for. He's going for that kind of tone. But he's kind of have to hold back a little bit because of the, you know, the fullness of those chords when you have also piano and voice and other instrumentation competing. You kind of have to pull back from that a little bit.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree with you on that. It's just, but this is the thing, right? When you start, when your criticism of an album is, well, you use the wrong instrument in that point, you're kind of clutching at straws, you know what I mean?
I'm assuming that they probably tried an acoustic underneath it, but it just didn't sound right.
They would have tried it.
They would have, it was like, oh, yeah, this, maybe the, I mean, this is the other thing as well. I know Rick Wakeman has talked about this before when he was working with David Bowie. David Bowie started all his songs from piano and a battered old 12-string guitar.
Yeah.
And the idea was that if it sounds good on 12-string and piano, then it can only get better. And then you add horns, you add strings, you add other instrumentation, and you're building upon such a great... He said too many bands start in the position of starting with great sounds and thinking everything is great, but it's not.
Yeah, well, I know that Chris Sheeny from The Living End subscribes to that idea as well. He turns around and basically says, well, you know, it can only get better if you've got a great song on an acoustic. If the song still sounds shit on an acoustic, it's a shit song,
Exactly.
Particularly when you're composing as well, you generally want to compose in a very simple manner and then add the layers as opposed to compose it all, unless you're very gifted. And there are people out there, and I think we mentioned him earlier, but Stephen Wilson, I think Stephen Wilson is one of these people who can hear the entire song fully produced in his head and he knows how to get there.
That's possibly true, but it will. I mean, I know the general idea for him will either start on piano or guitar.
Yes.
He starts from that base of like doing this thing and then, it'd be really interesting, although he's rather sniffy about his own abilities as a instrumentation and a player. It'd be really interesting to see him do some kind of tour where it's just kind of him and the piano. But I don't think he'd ever do that.
Hmm. Yeah. That would be interesting, actually.
That's one reason why I've been pushing like mad to get try and get Devin Townsend here with his little sort of acoustic tour thing. Because to hear some of his songs
that'd be awesome.
At an acoustic guitar and his voice would be really, really cool.
Yeah, I agree.
But people, if you want to, if you like what I'm saying here and you like the idea of Devin Townsend and an acoustic guitar, for Christ's sake, get in touch with a damn promoter and tell them how much you want this to happen.
Exactly.
And I would say the same thing as well.
We need to be a little more proactive as a music community to try and get these people down here.
Absolutely right. I mean, we've banged on about this for so long on this show. It's like, if you want your favorite band to tour here, there's no point talking to the band. They are sort of powerless in the terms of the economics of how they need to, you know, pay bills and stuff. They can't afford to fly. You know, it's hilariously expensive to tour Australia at the best of times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, with implicating, you know, never mind all the other problems that are currently going on with other music festivals, which is, again, not this show.
No.
So we have enough problems trying to get art in this country to happen. So we need people out there to say, well, I want this, why can't my favorite band come to Australia?
Exactly.
You know, people need to be, you know, and also, I mean, we've discussed this as well before. It's like Dream Theater need to have an Asian tour booked before they can come to Australia. So once get the slightest whiff that there's an Australian, an Asian tour in the books, then... You know, we'll start and we'll start hammering the promoters to get them out here.
I think that brings us to the final track on the album. Well, final track, unless you've got the bonus track. Final track, Pale Blue Dot. What do you think of this one, Hoggy?
This one's a really nice one, actually. Pale Blue Dot, of course, is sort of influenced from the imagery of the very famous Carl Sagan. Now, it's a lecture, isn't it? It's a lecture he gave, wasn't it?
The speech. Speech.
Oh, it's a speech. Okay.
Yeah.
You probably know a bit more about the speech than I do. Is there, you got any background on where this speech was and how it has sort of come to be in this song?
So The speech itself originated from an image that was taken by, I think it was Voyager, when it went past Pluto, just before it left the solar system. It actually turned around and took a photo back at the Earth, or where they thought the Earth would be. And it was one of those freaks of nature photos where you actually, the photo, you've probably all seen it. There's a big, it's sort of a black image, obviously, because it's shooting into space, and there's a big beam of light, like a sunbeam, running through the middle of space. And in the middle, almost dead smack in the middle of this beam of light, there's this little blue speck in the middle of it. And that's Earth, right? So Sagan wrote this speech called the Pale Blue Dot Speech about that image. And in it he says, see that dot? That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, every person that's ever lived, every person that ever will live, etc. And he goes on to basically talk about how this is, Earth is really the only, as it stands at the moment, this is it. This is all we've got, right? So we need to sort of look after it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. The exact quote it sort of ends with, to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Which sounds like something could have been said this sounds like something that could have been said last week. This is a quote from 1996.
Exactly. And it is a monumental speech. And I need to mention as well, these guys aren't the first guys to use the Pale Blue Dot speech. I remember Story of the Year used it on the Black Swan album. You know, so okay. I mean, it's not like this is going back. When was the Black Swan album? 2005 or something. So, you know, the Pale Blue Dot speech is one of those monumental speeches that will probably last history, I think, will last the course of time, as they say. So that's absolutely kind of the background to the Pale Blue Dot. The track itself is sort of based on that, from what I understand.
Yeah, pretty much. I think we've pretty much said all that. Said all that we need to say about that one. It's just a really, really nice song to end the album, I think, and sort of give a bit of hope to the world, I think.
Yeah, I agree. It's a, again, phenomenal track.
Yeah.
And that intro balls to the wall.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then we have, you know, the bonus track, Viper King, which we've already spoken about. It's like progressive Deep Purple. It's like Deep Purple's Highway Star on steroids. Kind of more progressive, exactly. Bigger. And, yeah, I really, really love it. I really, really love that song. That's a really, really good one. I do hope now, if we're going to get into, like, hopes and dreams for the live tour, I really hope they play that one. I really do. I think
it would be cool.
I think that
it would actually be really cool.
And I think of all the other things on this album, I think this one probably maybe sort of a little bit underrated because you've got all the other sort of big Dream Theater elements. But I think this one probably going to be a bit underrated, and I think it'll really, really go off live. I think it'll be a really, really cool song to hear live.
Absolutely.
What about you, Dave? Which one of all the tracks on the album, which one would you like to see live?
Which one would I like to hear live? Look, I'm going to put all my money on Bastille Warrior. Like I said to you, this is hands down my favorite track. So far as moshy, fucking brutal, balls to the wall kind of stuff, Paralyzed, almost imagine a pit opening up for that. And I mean, a Dream Theater mosh pit kind of closely resembles a Japanese maths schoolroom.
yeah, it's interesting, actually. You don't tend to get that much moshing, at least here in Australia anyway. It's not really mosh kind of band, which is
the
interesting.
The only time
we spoke about... Yeah, I was going to say, we spoke about this with Progfest because you had all like the metal guys bouncing and jumping around in the pit, and then you had all the sort of sniffy prog guys on the edge, like, ugh, you know, they're kind of scared off by the sort of heavy thing.
Yeah, absolutely. The only time I remember a pit opening up for these guys was As I Am, which was on their very first the very, very first show in Sydney in 2008. So I remember that because I was in the middle of it and I remember going nutso. And that was 10 years ago. Fuck me.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, for me, the song I really want to hear live, Paralyzed, Bastard Warrior, Untethered Angel for the ending, because as I've mentioned numerous times, ball terror of an ending.
Given that that's the lead single, I'd be very, very surprised if they don't play that one live.
Oh, yeah, absolutely,
like,
yeah.
Hey, we've got the lead single and we're not going to play it live. Fuck yous, you know, that's not going to happen.
Here's our new song. Let's get that piece of shit out of the way early and go back and do some other stuff. Thanks, Guitar Hero, for that quote. How about you? Which one are you hoping for?
Ooh, S2N, I'm definitely hoping they play that one live. That's going to be a big one, enough. I think. Viper King.
Absolutely.
I could almost see as well, I don't know how they'll do it with the structure of this particular tour because they've got the Scenes of the Memory for the second end, but I could almost see like them sort of, like, I think, well, they've kind of done this already with the dramatic tour of events where they had that acoustic bit in the middle where they sort of, you know, went down to just guitar and piano. And I could see either one of those two, probably more out of reach rather than at wit's end, I think. But that song sort of being done in that kind of way. But they've kind of already done that, so I don't know if they'd go back and do that again. But if they were going to, that would be definitely one that you could really have in there for that.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm really keen to see, these things are getting easier and easier to do and sort of have big projections behind them. They definitely went all out with that on The Astonishing. So I'd be really interested to see this tour and see how they do that this time around with this album. The projections.
Yeah.
I mean, you saw the music video for Paralyzed, right?
Yes, I did.
That
sort
of
was cool.
iRobot Minority Report kind of vibe to it.
Yep.
So really
yep.
interesting to see how they do that. And then, of course, I mean, the Scenes from Memory, that kind of, that, you know, I don't know whether they'll drag out the video from Roseland again. Probably not. They'll probably update that.
Yeah, probably.
But it'd be, you know, I think this tour is going to lend itself to those sorts of projections that will definitely add to the music. There's a lot of bands out there doing that now where they're adding those projections to the music to kind of create almost like a sort of film soundtrack kind of vibe to it.
Absolutely.
Marillion do that particularly well.
Yeah, so does Stephen Wilson. Stephen Wilson does that. Pink Floyd, obviously.
It's all coming from that Floyd influence, definitely that Pink Floyd influence.
Yeah, 100%.
And with 100%. Roger Waters running around doing his projections of late, you know, that's definitely something. There's obviously a lot of big solos on this record.
Yep.
Of all of them, which one is your favorite? I know this is like trying
Paralyzed.
To pick between... Yeah, Paralyzed?
Paralyzed. Yeah. Like that guitar solo in Paralyzed is... Fuck me, it's good. I mean, yeah, there's other great stuff on the album. And there's some other phenomenal songs and sounds on that album. Brilliant, brilliant stuff. But for me, I mean, for a 4:17 song... that has a guitar solo in it like that. Yeah, give me that. Give me that. How about you?
For me, I'm probably going to pick two of them. This is going to be interesting as well because I'm going to pick keyboard solos. You've picked the guitar solo.
So I'm going to pick...
The big one for me is that continuum solo at the end of S2N. I mean,
good point.
That's a really, really good one. I mean, they've kind of done that one before with the Dark Eternal Night, but it's just magic. I love that stuff. And also as well, the sort of Keith Emerson-style organ solo from Fall Into the Light, which we've discussed on a couple of occasions before.
Yeah.
I love both of those two. Those two are great.
Absolutely.
And also as well, I mean, the we've already discussed the outro from At Wit's End, so we'll put that one up there as well. I mean, those three are great.
You know, I mean, I'd love to see this album live, and I'm going to have the opportunity to do so in New York later on this year. I'm going to put a call out right now. If there are any listeners, and I know we do have some listeners from the United States, if there are any listeners based in New York who want to meet up on the day of the actual gig, please send us an email. We'll pick a coffee shop somewhere nearby. I assume New York does good coffee. I can't remember, to be really honest with you.
The Americans don't do good coffee. What are you talking about? It's like Starbucks or Starbucks. Sorry, that's just me being sniffy about American coffee.
No, that's fair. Then a beer. Whatever. By all means, send us through an email and we'll organise a meetup prior to the show, prior to getting our brains absolutely blown out, watching these guys and faces melted and so on and so forth. Also, on a slightly different note, if there are any promoters that are listening to this, and we're probably getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here, but if there are any promoters or anything listening to this in the Australian leg of things, can I make a real quick suggestion? Don't give Dream Theatre the Horden Pavilion again. Do the Enmore Theatre. It's a way better venue. It's easier to get to for everyone, and they'll sell it out. It's a much better venue, in my opinion.
Isn't the problem with the Enmore Theatre, though, that it's a seated gig? Isn't that the problem?
Enmore is standing.
It's a standing gig.
Enmore's standing.
Yeah. Okay, cool. The Horden Pavilion was seated last time, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, they actually put chairs in. And even then, it wasn't sold out.
Oh, God damn it. Yeah. We've already yelled enough about this already, about what I think of, like, seated arena gigs. And I'm going to get two more this year as well, but those particular bands, that was inevitable. I bought tickets to Fleetwood Mac, and I've bought tickets for Elton John as well.
Yeah. Actually, tell a lie, the Enmore Theatre is seated, but I think it's removable seating from memory.
Okay.
I think you can have it general admission, or you can have it seated as well, I think, from memory, because I'm pretty sure I've seen both there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just hoping that they come to Australia at all. Them coming to Perth is obviously never going to happen because they just don't.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's just not enough people here. You know, the super fans like myself and, you know, and Kale and the other guys will probably fly over for it.
Yep.
I don't think they're ever going to come to Perth. But also as well, a shout out to those promoters. Get in touch with us. Tell us what we need to do to make this happen. Help me to help you. Help me to help you. You know, we want them to come to Australia as probably as much as you do. So tell us what we have to do. Pretty sure it's
absolutely.
I did speak to Tom Bowler at one point and it was like, yeah, we've got to wait for them to get the Asian tour book. I'd love to get that confirmed by somebody.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be nice, actually.
We've spoken about live gigs already, and I've already spoken that I'm gonna go and I will be seeing them in Bulgaria. Which will be good fun. That'll probably be a very similar show, if not the same show. They might do the A and B set list thing again. Who knows?
Maybe. Who knows?
So, definitely looking forward to it.
As always, every week, thank you guys for listening, because we can't do this show. I mean, but we can. We can just have the two of us screaming into the ether, but it's always better when we know that there are people listening, and there are people listening. We've got all the metrics, and we've actually got quite a global audience, which is absolutely awesome.
Just as a point of view, I've pulled up a list here. We have listeners in all of the following countries: Australia, Austria, Belgium, Brazil, Bulgaria, Canada, Chile, China, Croatia, the Czech Republic, France, Germany, Hong Kong, Hungary, India, Indonesia, Ireland, Italy, Japan, Lebanon, Mexico, Myanmar, Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Peru, Philippines, Russia, Slovakia, South Africa, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, Taiwan. Interesting that they call that a separate country. That's a whole other cat. Okay, we're just going to skip right over. Thailand, Turkey, the United Kingdom, the United States, and Vietnam.
Yeah, so
that's
to
everyone.
All you guys who are listening to us from all of those countries, we just want to say thank you, and thanks for supporting us. And we just hope you guys do yourselves a favor. Go out, buy this album, pre-order it. You know, well, you don't have to pre-order it now. It's out. But you definitely want to listen to this album. Go and listen to it on your favorite streaming service. But buying it obviously helps the band a little bit more out. So, and thank you for listening.
And also as well, we'd also love to hear what you think of this album.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would love to hear what you think of this album. So please drop us a line, send us an email, tweet at us. You can tweet us at 98FM. You can find us on the Dream Theatre Fan Club of Australia and New Zealand on Facebook. We'd love to hear what you guys think of this record.
Absolutely. We'd love to get your feedback about the album. You know, what's your favorite one? What are you hoping to see live? What's your favorite solo? Because these are all things I think that we as Dream Theatre, that the really cool thing about the Dream Theatre community and the prog community in general is that not everyone's going to be the same. You know, you're not going to have all the people whose favorite song is that one they released because that's the one that got airtime. You know, everyone's going to be there for something different. And that's what really makes this community great.
Absolutely. So until next time, my name is Alex Hogg.
My name is David Ellis.
We'll see you all next time.
See you then.
See ya.